He is African American, a hip-hop artist, and a voice that provides clarity and optimism in a world that can seem not so sane sometimes. She is a white woman, a spiritual teacher who grew up in the South. She was raised in the heart of Mississippi, surrounded by discrimination. For over 25 years, she has pointed us towards freedom by asking us to look deeper than our thoughts. So, what happens when these two people with very different backgrounds come together to talk about skin color? Well, we're about to find out. This is a conversation about racism, where it comes from, why we believe it, and just maybe how to transcend it.
We didn't have a choice for what skin color we came out with, you know? It's not our fault, you know? So I think we have to see this. We have to recognize this and look deeper. And once we look deeper, we see that reality is what we make it, and there's no other way to make it other than out of love.
This month, Gongti Radio welcomes Prince EA for a conversation about what it means to be black, what it means to be white, and what it means to give up those definitions altogether. I'm Hillary Larson, and this is a special edition of A Conversation with Gongti. I just wanted to give everybody a little bit of background about this particular topic that we're going to cover today. And, you know, a few months ago, I just thought this would be such a great topic to cover because it just seems like this whole subject of racism is reaching this fever pitch in this country. And I think it's definitely related to the election of President Obama. But when I looked at it, I thought this conversation between me and Gongti would be a great conversation because I think there's a lot to be said for what two liberal white women think about racism. And then Gongti, with this perception that she has of always seeing deeper than what's deeper than the color of your skin, but what are the layers before that? And then we were graced by your gracious acceptance of our invitation to join us in this conversation. So I just, first of all, just wanted to say thank you for flying all the way from St. Louis to be with us here in Ashland.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
So what I'm really interested about is, you know, when it comes to racism, it's like what's not being said. Because there are overt acts of racism happening all the time, and they're on the news. And it's easy for those of us that disagree with that to stand up and say, I disagree with that. It's not fair. But I also think there's a different conversation that lurks underneath that. For even those of us that disagree with racism, like what is underneath that still that's not being spoken that keeps that system intact?
You're looking at me, so I'm looking at you. Okay. Well, I think, you know, I am really happy to bring my background to this conversation because I grew up in Mississippi and in a racist atmosphere. That was the way I was conditioned. And I accepted it because I didn't know to question it. We had maids who were African American, and there was a section of town that was African American. I had no idea the music that was being played there at that time. Turns out that the town I grew up in, Clarksdale, Mississippi, was like an epicenter of blues. Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson had played there. But, of course, we didn't know that because we saw the whole culture as somehow inferior. I didn't have a cruel family, but the superiority of the white-skinned ones was unquestioned until I went to college and had a professor who happened to be from Harvard, but he was at Ole Miss, where I was in college, this very racist college, and he questioned me on it in a way that waked me up, at least got me investigating, well, where did this come from? How do I justify this? And I am indebted to him forever, because in the belly of the beast, there's no place worse to be for a person with black skin than Mississippi at that time. This was this light, this force of light. And so I questioned it, and then the civil rights movement came, and I was a part of that marching. And then I also was teaching school in Memphis, Tennessee, and after I graduated from college, obviously. And I had a group of very bright English students. I was teaching English, and they were primarily African-American, and I just went out on a limb, and I brought in two James Baldwin books, The Fire Next Time and Go Tell It on the Mountain. Somehow my principal let me order enough for all these kids, and we studied those books. And then I got to see how shocking that was for some of the black students. Like, it was too much for them, because they also were, they knew their bubble, and they didn't like it. It wasn't right. But to threaten it at that time, that was 1964, was too much. But we did anyway. And so I have always said that's truly one of the proudest moments of my life, that I loved the marches, and I felt that, and I wept with the horror of it. But to meet with young people and to say, you know, as a white, and now as an old white lady from Mississippi, to meet with this young man and to know that we are meeting with, it's not even equals, because it's not in the realm of measurement. We are meeting consciousness to consciousness. And in that, then, we can see, how is it possible that these distinctions arise? You know, I have my theories, but I'll let Prince E.A. talk some.
Well, that was beautiful. My background in, you know, dealing with race, you know, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and St. Louis is very segregated. But even growing up, my person, you know, I saw race, but I didn't, it wasn't a rigid idea for me that I held on to. You know, I always saw people as people. You know, I knew it was, you know, good people, one skin color, bad people, another skin color. You know, it's so, you can't really go just by skin color alone to judge someone. I always knew that. And then I ended up getting my study in anthropology, which that's what they taught. You know, it was the sameness of human culture, not the differences. They emphasized the likeness and uniqueness, you know, things like the Human Genome Project that showed us that we're so similar, you know, that skin color is only about, you know, 6 genes. And, you know, we've got tens of thousands of genes, and, you know, skin color is nothing more than our ancestors' relationship to the sun. And, you know, it's an adaptation. Pigment is an adaptation to, you know, can you absorb vitamin D? You know, if you're lighter skin, you're in places where it's less sunlight, less UVs. If you're darker skin, then you're in, you know, more intense UV rays, you know, it's closer to the equator, Africa. So, you know, this knowledge, it just, you know, the little understanding and, I guess, belief that I had about race, it totally dissolved. At that point, it was nothing more than a cultural construct that we as a society continue to perpetuate. And it's not living in truth. And so that's my standpoint. That's become my standpoint on it.
I'm sitting here resisting not making a remark about your remark about being an old white woman, because there's plenty of people that are listening to this that are laughing about that right now, because it's so the opposite. I wanted to actually, many of the conversations that I have with Gangaji, we come back always around to this idea of just telling the truth. So I'd like to do that with the two of you, because this is where I think dismantling the underpinnings of this system happens, and it's by conversations like this. So I would have to say that I grew up in a, you know, an all-white town. There was a black family that moved in when I was in high school, and it was like, whoa, like there's a black family moving in. And I came from a family that was very liberal. I worked in the African-American community in Portland for really severely underserved people for 10 years. I dedicated my life to it. I have really strong opinions about racism. I don't like it, and I don't think it's right. At the same time, I was in an elevator the other day, and a black man got on the elevator, and I was by myself, and I held onto my purse. And I just watched myself, that biological, genealogical, societal, cultural momentum is still in my system. And if I feel like if we're not willing to tell the truth about those things that are just kind of sitting there within us, that we're like, oh, I don't really want anybody to know that about me. Mm-hmm. How are we ever going to be free?
Mm. It's very important to tell the truth, the relative truth, and then to look deeper. I never was afraid of African Americans because I grew up in a sense that they weren't threatening me. I suspect my ancestors were afraid and then built this cocoon and separation. But I found that once my racism was exposed, it was not patronizing exactly, but like, ooh, look how beautiful. Mm-hmm. Look how different. Mm-hmm. Which felt great. And I don't think it's harmful, but it's still not, something's missing in that. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't even really articulate what it is, but it's some, I'm very aware of difference in skin color. Mm. You know, if I walk into a room and there's one black person, one Chinese person, one white person, I know that when I walk out of the room. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's possibly hardwired into us, just to be really aware, maybe from past threats or just a tribal identity. But it's really where that awareness goes that counts. I don't think we have to see each other as the same color. But we can, as you were just saying, see how thin the veneer of color is, and then we appreciate the color. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, what is more beautiful than dark skin? I mean, I know that as a white-skinned person. I know how many days I've sat in the sun trying to get a little darker. So when we tell the truth about that, it's like, oh, what appreciation is seen. Mm. Unless there's some patronizing going on with that too, and that's where we have to, I think,
it's find funny, the edge. It's funny you mentioned how beautiful dark skin is when it's also a phenomenon of the skin whitening, the skin lightening across the world where, you know, I think mostly in Brazil where they put toxic chemicals on their skin to lighten their skin, you know, so this standard of beauty, for me as a student of anthropology, is really arbitrary. I think all skin color is, like you were saying, is really beautiful when we can appreciate all the shades, and recognize that each one has its evolutionary history, and it's really beautiful. But it is just the costume that we wear. There's something deeper within us, and that's when you find what's deep, then you can find the truth, not necessarily just believing what your culture has thrown on you. The conditioning, I guess you would say. It's when you do the research, you find out that race as an idea was, you know, it doesn't go back further than the 1500s. Mm-hmm. It was invented to separate, to divide us. Even the concept of whiteness was created because, you know, back then you had indentured servants and you had the slaves, and the black slaves and the indentured servants were starting to come together. So the hierarchy, the people on the, you know, the controllers, the slave masters, whatever you want to say, created this idea of whiteness so that they could divide those two from taking over. This is exactly what happened. And so it was a divided, you know, united we stand, divided we fall. Mm-hmm. And anytime you divide people, you're going to fight. And they can't come together in order to overthrow the regime that was there. So that's the history of it. And it's unfortunate that we don't investigate, you know, we don't look into it. We kind of just accept. For me, I think the best thing somebody can do is to unlearn everything and find out for themselves, you know, to experience, to do the research and to question, to doubt, in order to really be a to live life fully, you know, you have to doubt things that you've been told, I think, in order to find out for yourself and live your truest version of yourself.
Absolutely. And it seems to me that the only time you discover that capacity to question, to inquire, to doubt the assumptions that you've assumed is when you aren't threatened by what you see, or at least you don't believe the threat to the degree that you go to war with what's in front of you. Because it's still what's happening, of course, is history you're talking about. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that about the 15th century. And it's still, of course, and then we talk about class warfare, and we talk about the power structure and the superior structure, and it turns out that there were white people who were setting lower white people against the slaves, who were the lowest of the hierarchy. And that's still what we see, you know, and even though it defeats everybody except the ones who are on the top, and they're defeated too, of course, because their lives are built on maintaining a status quo that's about cruelty and falsity.
Wow.
Yep. So it's really for everyone the possibility of recognizing, as you were saying, Hillary, in this time of intensity, because it's once again been flushed up to the top of our conversation, of really what does it mean, you know, skin color, and how do I participate in that, and how can I contribute to seeing deeper, and that's really the way I see all of our conversations. But this one is very, I mean, urgent. It's been urgent since the 15th century, really, then. Mm-hmm. But we put it out of sight.
You know, I'm probably asking the wrong people this question, but with you two sitting in front of me, is that I wonder, in your daily lives, are there moments where something old comes up, some old prejudice for you, Prince EEA, maybe it's about white people, and Gongaji, maybe it's about black people. Do you ever have moments where it's like, whoa, where did that come from? And what do you do with that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the residue, the lingering. I have prejudice that is on that subconscious level about black people, about white people, about everybody, you know, it comes out. And I just watch it, you know, I just observe it, and then it just, it dissolves. It's because it's untrue, you know, it's it's a thought, it's an idea that isn't founded in anything that's true. So I just like to observe it, you know. I'm okay, I'm not trying to, I shouldn't have these thoughts, I shouldn't, you know, I just, it's
that's
okay.
Beautiful. Yeah. It's so beautiful. Then you don't have to keep them hidden, because it seems like that's when they're the most dangerous, is when they become subconscious. And then they're just reality. This is just right. These people are bad, or these people are threatening me. Yeah, it's wonderful. You know, I think that I would agree that it's really what the thoughts about everybody. This person is different, or this person is going to hurt me, or this person doesn't get me, or whatever it may be. We have these mechanisms that just spin based on conditioning or past, but they can be interrupted, and they are interrupted when you don't follow them. The power drains out, because they only have the power because of centuries of being fed as correct and real and necessary. It's very interesting to listen to a white supremacist speak, and a black supremacist too, I would assume, but a white supremacist, because that has been the power structure for so long, and they are true believers. And I had to realize when I looked back at my upbringing in the South and my forefathers who did own slaves, and my father, who was really a good man, really believed that he was protecting Southern womanhood. Because, let's face it, black men are more attractive than white men. So, of course they were threatened. Just kidding. But, you know, I mean, in the South, based on slavery, there had been a breeding program. I mean, that's who the top slaves were, the biggest and the strongest. And so there was this underclass of very strong people. They had to be. They worked in the fields all day. They had to be really strong. And there was great fear in the white structure about that, fear of revolts, fear of rebellions, and they did happen occasionally. And that fear, I would say, was still alive in my father. He was born in the 1920s, and till he died, he was still afraid. But I don't know that he would have said he was afraid. Mm-hmm. I'm certain he wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. It would have been by the time it got to his conscious mind, it was that, no, he's just, these people could, you know, cause harm, and this idea of purity of the races. Mm-hmm. I remember saying to him once, Daddy, we all come from Africa. At that time, I was planning to go to mm-hmm. Africa. I said, mm-hmm. I'm going to the motherland, mm-hmm. you know. And his eyes just got really big, because by then he knew not to get into those conversations with me. But we are all of each other already, and it's, can we love the totality of ourselves? Mm. Can we accept the totality of ourselves? Mm. The scary parts, the threatening parts, the strong parts, the stupid parts, the ignorant parts, the threatened parts.
Yeah. To be courageous to face these things, to face what we fear. For me, it's an old saying that life is the constant practice of falling. You know, it's the art of falling, right? The falling is mandatory, but the hurting is optional. You know, things happen, and it's all dependent on us. How we choose to interpret what's happening is what affects us. You know, this is what I think I learned a long time ago, that my mind was the world. You know, everything that appears, it happens in my mind. It's like another saying, the only difference between a flower and a weed is a judgment. You know, if you're a gardener that wants to plant, you know, dandelions, then that's a flower. You know, it's really all about how we want to look at things, how we want to interpret things, questioning our thoughts. You know, that's what your friends with Byron Katie, I think, you know, good friend of mine as well. Is that thought true? Mm. You know, we have to sit down and question all of our thoughts. Is it true? All of these thoughts that we've had forced on us, thoughts that we've had, just assimilated into us, you know, unconsciously, subliminally. Is it true? You know, and that's freedom when we can actually do that and step back.
That's right. That's questioning the authority, mm-hmm. whether that's in our own mind or the collective mind. It's always part of each. Mm. Questioning that authority. We know to question other authority, but to question the authority in our own mind, that's the... Yes.
Yes.
You know, we're laughing.
There's this... I would call it the depth of compassion when you peel away these layers, and to be able to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes, even a few steps in somebody else's shoes. And I have these moments in time in my life that are kind of frozen in time in my mind. And I dated an African-American man for off and on for years. And Portland is very segregated. As liberal as it is, it's very segregated. Mm. And this was 20 years ago, so it was much different than it is now, but it's still segregated. And so he and I were riding in a car together in the black part of town. And I glanced over, and there were these black women sitting in the car next to us. And they looked at me like, it was like the death stare, you know, and I'm sitting here, this white girl sitting in the car. And it was unnerving for me, and it felt unfair to me. And then my next thought was like, wow, what would it be like to live like that all the time? When somebody's just looking at you like, what are you doing here? And that's what we've been seeing in all these various pockets of America. And so that's to me where this depth of compassion comes in.
Because that's really the flip of, if my father had seen, you know, that it would be staring too at you both, probably. How dare you take my woman? How dare you take one of ours? Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, what you were getting there, you know, because men are a premium and women are a premium when we are just looking at it in terms of sexual selection or how do we get ours strong. But when we're speaking of something that is bigger than our tribalism, and we see, I mean, what tribalism does in the world and how horrific it is. We can see that in the Middle East, in Israel, everywhere, this tribalistic understanding that is not even about the color of one's skin, but it takes it out into where you grew up or what your religion is or how extreme your religion is. And to be willing to, as you did, to open to that. Initially feel threatened by that. It doesn't feel good to get the death stare. But then to open to that, and to recognize that, you know, we all get that in different ways. You have surely gotten that in some way as a woman in your profession. And I got it even as a Southerner out of the South. I mean, people made an assumption I was stupid. And I had to just stay with it and stay with it and stay with it. And they thought, oh, well, maybe she has something to say. Mm-hmm. These assumptions are huge. Mm-hmm. And when you say to question the assumption, this is really calling people to a level of intelligence that's been denied, and then compassion comes from that, because compassion is natural, empathy is natural.
It's the only thing you can do when you see it as it is, you know. It's Hillary, I've actually had an experience like that. I've dated every race, ethnicity, like a lot of race, ethnicity, women. And, you know, going different places where it's like an all white bar or something, you might get looked at, you know. But even then, I don't know. I write it off. It's just people that might have some issues of their own that they're dealing with. It's like when you have these situations, you have to put yourself in their shoes, you know. And once you do that, you know, if you had their history, their thoughts and ideas as strongly as they do, then you would be them. You would have the same reaction. And only compassion and peace can come from that. You understand, you know.
It's beautiful.
I wonder if we could go from there to me, what is the deepest inquiry in this system? And that is, let's say that those that are in power, and so those would be white people, let's just say that there is an even playing ground in the imaginal world. The fear that evokes, even for somebody who is pro-equal rights, is that I'm going to lose something. I'm going to lose some power. I'm going to lose some privilege. I'm going to lose maybe the job I want. I'm not going to get, because now it's an even playing field. I just want to actually go to the core of the fear of changing the system, because I can talk about it all day long. I can preach about it. But if it became a reality, how are we threatened in this power structure?
Yeah, it's all based on fear, though, Hillary. Everything. Every threat is based on fear, and every perceived threat is based on fear. If we can recognize there's a difference, and that the threat really has nothing to do with the color of someone's skin, and the perceived threat does, that one is like steps away from reality, and that's huge. But that's, I think, what maybe the species is ready for. Because as you've said, and I think that's so brilliant, and I didn't know that about the 15th century, in the scope of things, it's not that old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very modern construct.
Yeah.
And it does, the basis of it all is fear. You know, it's, interestingly enough, it's money as well. You know, race was created as a socioeconomic construct to divide people so that the top elite could maintain their status quo. Mm-hmm. That's it. It was created out of love of money.
Yeah.
Separating. It has nothing to do with some, genetic inferiority. It evolved into that, but as a way to, explain it. And explain why I'm discriminating against somebody, which is social Darwinism and things like that. But it started as fear, as an economic way to separate people and to maintain the status quo.
Fear of losing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fear always what it gets down to, mm-hmm. isn't it? And so that's what has to be met.
Yeah, yeah.
So, because we do lose, finally, everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if we're willing to lose, I mean, this is the nature of inquiry. Mm. You have to lose all your preconceptions.
Mm. In order to get everything to be free, you
yeah.
know, that's the greatness of it, because it's so oxymoronic. It's
yes,
it's paradoxical. it's once we abandon all of these concepts and constructs, we're here, we're happy, we're free
yes,
to be who we are. You know, so I think it's easy to hate a group of people when you don't know them, when you just have an image or a caricature, you know, when you just see that them is that, and that's that little box that you put them in. But once you get to know them, know that they have the same issues, the same problems, the same fears and prejudices as you do, that we're all human, then that's where we can dismiss a lot of these divisions that we've created. That's what brings us together. That gives us the tolerance, and not only tolerance, but understanding and love, that we can see that we're all, this is the human experience. You know, nobody had we didn't have a choice for what skin color we came out with, you know. It's not our fault, you know, so I think we have to see this, we have to recognize this and look deeper. And once we look deeper, we see that reality is what we make it, and there's no other way to make it other than out of love.
Mm. Well, may we meet. May we all meet.
I just want to thank you both so much for, to me, the beauty of this conversation with the two of you really is that you have inspired people in so many different ways to look deeper and to ask what is really true. And so before we say goodbye, I'm going to play a clip from Gongaji, and she's talking about, this is from 2007, and she, obviously Barack Obama had just been elected, and you know, it doesn't matter what your political affiliation is when you're listening to this, but your point was that what a moment in history when a black man is elected president, what it cuts through in ourselves and what that has to do with freedom in general. So I'm going to play that. But
and what it evoked, what it has evoked,
right.
Which is possibly why it's exploding.
Gongaji, I would love it if you could give us a takeaway from this conversation. Is what do we walk away with? What is our responsibility with any, even the smallest awareness from this conversation?
It's possible to be free. It's your birthright to be free. And it's time. I know within each of us there is the possibility and the likelihood of some division of power, some aspects of ourselves or other that are not allowed into the power circle, some parts that we call the dark or the less than or the inferior. And when an event like this happens in the material universe, in the historical present time, there's a possibility for that to be blown wide apart, to see the fallacy of that, to see that that is the status quo, and to allow that to just dissolve in the possibility that you are free, that freedom is your birthright, regardless of what you have been told, regardless of what you believe, regardless of what your experience has proved to you, regardless of that, you are free.
your whole. And to surrender to that, to vote for that, to say yes to that, to say yes to that, rather than to continue to follow the discussion of, well, maybe if there's a no, now, in this moment, before your imperfections are erased, now, you are free.
If you'd like to find out more about Prince EA and the inspiring work he's doing in the world, the best place to find him is on Facebook, and you can also search for him on YouTube. Coming up in October, the subject of our attention in a couple different ways is about intimate relationships. Gangaji's live monthly webcast with Gangaji will focus on that subject. That's both on the webcast and over the course of the in-person weekend that's happening in Ashland. That all starts on October 16th and it goes through the 18th. And then here on Gangaji Radio, we'll be starting a 3-part series on relationships. That kicks off in October and goes through December. You can get information about With Gangaji and Gangaji Radio by going to the website, gangaji.org. This show only happens with your support, so if you'd like to find out how to be a monthly donor or a sponsor, just click on the radio tab or write us here at gangajiradio@gangaji.org. Thank you all for joining us for this very special edition of Gangaji Radio. Thank you to you, Prince EA. We so much appreciated this time you so generously spent with us. And to all of you, be well. We'll see you next time.